When his personal life started to spin out of control, Connor Knighton decided it was time to catch his breath. And he did that by visiting what people have called America's best idea. His bosses at CBS Sunday Morning agreed that a TV series on each one of the U.S. national parks would be worth the year it would require to visit them all. Connor joins us now to tell us what he discovered about America at each of its national parks. He writes about it in his book, Leave Only Footprints.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Give us kind of the backstory to your book before we get into the parks. What was the impetus for the book, and how did it relate to your personal life and to the CBS series that you work on Sunday Morning?
So I actually was about to get a Rick Steves book and head to Europe. My plan for that year was very different. I was engaged to be married. And then in the middle half of 2015, my then fiance called off the engagement. I was, you know, adrift. I was very sad at the time and sort of in a self-imposed kind of self-quarantine where I was sitting around the house. You know, this future that I thought I had lined up for me had disappeared. And my friends were telling me, you got to get back out there. I think I overcorrected in that department. I really got out there, really got a change of scenery. I'd seen that it was going to be the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service in 2016. And I thought, well, that could be a cool series of stories for Sunday Morning. It could also just be exactly what I needed in my own life. And so I pitched my bosses in New York to do a series of stories on the parks. They said yes, not to all of them. They said that we'd maybe do a third for the broadcast. And then at that moment, I decided, you know what, I'm going to go all in, make up the difference, and see those other two thirds on my own. So I gave up my place, hit the road, and went out to go see them all in a year.
Boy, talk about a crossroads in your life, from one thing that you thought was going to happen to something entirely different, and then making a bonus out of it, taking a year off, visiting all the parks. Now, the parks are famously called America's best idea. Why do they say that? And do you agree after visiting them all?
I do. And actually, when that phrase gained popularity, it was in relation to Europe in a lot of ways. Some of the most beautiful places in Europe were privately owned, or at some king's courtyard or whatever. And in the US, places like Yellowstone, Yosemite, there was this idea that they should be for everyone. They should not be only for the rich. They should be accessible by all people, owned by the people of the United States. And so those parks, which began with just a handful and then have included now 400 some park sites, everything from rivers to seashores to national monuments. That idea is uniquely American and now has since been replicated in countries across the world. And it made me surprisingly proud to be an American. It's tough not to stand in those places, right, looking at one of those vistas and not to realize that you're a co-owner of some of the best real estate in the world.
Oh, I love that concept, a co-owner. Now, as co-owners, I would want the parks to be well-managed. I want them to be well-run. You visited all of them over the course of a year. When you come away from that, did you feel like they're in good hands? What did you take away about how they're doing, how they're being run?
Well, so on a personal level, I've yet to meet a boring park ranger. I'm sure they're out there, but to a person, everyone I met was there for the right reasons. It's not a job you do for the money. I mean, you're a government worker in some very remote areas. They're there because they love that work. That said, I don't think that there is a park that would say that they're appropriately funded. There's a multi-billion dollar backlog of maintenance in the parks, roads and trails and all sorts of things that need to be done. So on that level, we could prioritize them more from a funding perspective. But the attitude there on the ground is, I think, the appropriate attitude.
And I would think that the Park Service is a mission-driven organization where people at every level of employment there have this love of nature and so on. Did you find that?
I did, yeah. It's in a way almost like you're in a nature army where you sort of do a tour of duty. And since I was on my own tour that year where I'm hitting many parks, I was surprised how good I got at the name game, where I could go to Virgin Islands National Park and have a ranger tell me she used to work at Congaree in South Carolina. And instantly, I would know someone that she knew because the park rangers just kind of cycle through different parks. But yeah, they all seem mission-driven. It may take a while. If your life's dream is to work at the Grand Canyon, well, so's everyone. So you may have to put in some time at a small museum in Philadelphia or something before you get there. But yeah, it did feel very mission-driven. And you feel that in the visitors too. You feel this kinship with folks who you're out on the trail with, where you have something in common with them. You have both chosen to spend your leisure time in this protected place at a time when there are so many other things competing for your attention. You start to feel that kinship with other visitors in the parks.
And when you say something in common, when you think about our country today, there's a lot of division. We're quite a fractured country at this time. And if we go to the parks, that's something we might have in common. What's your takeaway just on how parks can help our country unify in a time when we're searching for common ground?
Yeah, I mean, they are literally our common ground in that they are owned and paid for by all of us. And those divisions that can seem so stark everywhere else disappear when you're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon or plodding through the great sand dunes of Colorado. They also enjoy overwhelming levels of support. You know, there are some political issues with the parks, whether it's mining or hunting on different land. There are controversies for sure, but you say some of these places and everyone loves them. and that's nice. What else can we say that about? Yeah, they bring folks together and you don't feel those divisions enough. That said, there are some issues with diversity and access in the parks where it's not as for everyone as the mission would seem to make you believe, but they're working on that.
And when you're standing on the edge of a canyon and you're gazing out at that and you see what we have to be thankful for and what we have in common, you also may be reminded that this was Native American property first. What was your experience on how the parks are acknowledging that? I mean, now when you go to Canada, you're constantly reminded about First Nations and so on. Is there a new awareness in this time when we're trying to be more mindful of diversity and respecting different peoples that we acknowledge that this is generally Native American property before it was national park?
Yeah, I mean, it's a belated acknowledgement for sure, but the parks are starting to shift those narratives where that is a story, whether it's just putting an exhibit in the visitor center or incorporating it into a ranger program or providing access for religious practices for tribes that are in that area. That's all getting better. But yeah, it's the story of so many of these places. By the way, it's the story of so many of our cities as well. It's just the parks are the last places left that might look like the same land hundreds and thousands of years ago. It's tough to keep that story top of mind when you're wandering around Cleveland, but when you're in wandering through Moab near Arches National Park, you can think about who used to live there. And sometimes you see visual reminders. Capitol Reef National Park in Utah has petroglyphs, and you're standing there as I'm feeling a religious experience and then seeing these paintings that were most likely some sort of religious expression of a culture thousands and thousands of years older is a powerful experience to have that.
Connor Knighton is our socially distanced home studio guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He writes about what he discovered in a year visiting each one of the U.S. national parks in his book, Leave Only Footprints. Connor also has produced the On the Trail and Island Hopping travel reports for CBS Sunday Morning. His website is ConnorKnighton.com.
So, Connor, when you put together the book, Leave Only Footprints, which covers all of the parks from Acadia to Zion, you didn't group it geographically. You grouped it by themes. And I've seen different books on the national parks, but I haven't seen it done this way. What was your point? Why did you end up grouping it this way?
Well, I realized one advantage I had in having seen all of them and not just some of them is that I had this perspective where I was able to see the threads that tie these wildly different places together. So Kobuk Valley National Park, north of the Arctic Circle, and Cuyahoga Valley National Park, right outside Cleveland, are far away and the topography is very different, but both had stories to teach me about living off the land and the importance of food. I grouped some parks together based on lessons of forgiveness or God and a chronological journey. When I look back on the year, I don't think of it that way. Also, my chronology was very confusing because I was sometimes, because I was producing these segments for the show, I was circling back. So I think it would just, for anyone who is semi-familiar with a map, it would have been a very confusing chronological, like, why is this guy going back to Great Smoky Mountains? Didn't he pass that in February? And the truth is I did, but the piece I wanted to do there, which was on this cemetery that provides access once a year, that happened in June. So I had to hightail it back from Mount Rainier and a week later go all the way back to Great Smoky Mountains. So it was a lot of crisscrossing the country.
You know, Connor, I know from my experience that you can take two people to the same place and they can have two different experiences depending on what's going on inside of them and what attitude they bring and what understanding they bring to that site or that experience. You brought your own emotional and psychological baggage with you to these parks. What can you advise people who are going to be going to a park anywhere to get the most out of it or to get out of their comfort zone or be transformed? Isn't a good part of that not how great the park is, but how able we are to give ourselves up to it?
Absolutely. I think a good example of that is Isle Royale National Park off the northern coast of Michigan. That's a park where the scenery isn't so stunning. I'm sure Michiganders would disagree with me, but it's part of it is how isolated you are at that park. That was the experience that I took away. It's a park in the lower 48, at least, with extremely long levels of visitation. So the Grand Canyon, for example, might have like a 3.5 hour average visit. It's like 3.5 days or something thereabouts for Isle Royale, because once you get there, which requires a seaplane or a boat, you stay there. And so that experience of being completely disconnected, both from the land and also from cell phone service, taking everything you need on your back, hiking for 4 days in a loop around the island, that's an experience that's different than maybe a must-see attraction like the main arch in Arches. There's no must-see attraction at Isle Royale, but in a way, it was a more transformative experience for me because of how alone I was at that park.
You know, you've got a line in your book called Missing the Forest for the Tweets. And, you know, it's a quandary. As a tour guide, I know people are looking at their cell phone too much. They're just got their selfie stick up and they're not even in the moment. Did you notice that this is a challenge for people who are trying to appreciate parks in our country?
It is. It's also a challenge for the parks themselves as they struggle with how connected they want to be. You know, does that mean having Wi-Fi at the visitor center? Does that mean blanketing the entire park with a Verizon tower? The upside of that connectivity would be search and rescue becomes much easier when you can call for help. The flip side of that one is that maybe people are more likely to take trips they shouldn't take because they think that they're just a 911 call away from that rescue. So it's this real delicate balance of encouraging access, especially among younger people. If the parks aren't popular with today's 20-somethings, then when those 20-somethings or 50-somethings and are prioritizing where to spend their money, take their families on vacation, who to vote for, why would they prioritize places they've never been or experienced? And sadly, if you want to get a 20-year-old to come to a park, sometimes that means ensuring them that they can check Instagram while they're there. And so I am of the camp more of trying to shut off as much as possible, but I try not to be too judgmental about that, because that experience of taking a picture and posting it for your friends, friends back in a city who have maybe never seen a place like that, that can be important too.
That's true. That advertises a beautiful thing.
It does, yeah. The flip side of that is sometimes it drives people to a destination that maybe can't handle that influx of people. There are some places and parks that used to just be known to the most in-the-know guides and hikers. And now when there's a geotagged coordinate for that, everybody tries to go to that vista, and that can sometimes damage those resources. So it's a balance.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Connor Knighton. Connor spent a year visiting each of America's national parks in order to create a series of video travel reports that aired on CBS Sunday Morning. He takes us behind the scenery and he writes about what each one showed him in his book, Leave Only Footprints. We have a link to Connor's work with this week's show. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. Connor, you set out and you had to visit all the parks because that was your goal. I imagine some of the parks you were eager to see and others you were thinking, well, I got to go there because it's on the list. What were the surprising parks? Which ones that you visited were actually more rewarding or exciting than you expected?
Well, I was surprised when I looked down that list when I was first conceiving of this, how many I hadn't heard of. I just kind of assumed that like they would all be recognizable names. And in a way, it's what convinced me that it would be a good idea for a series and then ultimately a book, is that how many of them were complete unknowns to me. So Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado, one of the quietest places in the country, this bit of the Sahara that seems like it was transposed onto the Rocky Mountains. Never heard of that place before. Many of the remote Alaskan parks, Gates of the Arctic, Katmai, Lake Clark, I wasn't familiar with any of those. But I'd say Biscayne National Park was a nice surprise for me, because that's a park just south of Miami. You can see the Miami skyline from the visitor center. And really, if you were to look out at that park, it doesn't look like much. It looks like the ocean. It looks like much of South Florida. But the surprise is waiting for you just beneath the surface of that ocean. And so at that park, I went on an underwater trail. I got scuba certified and went diving down to these shipwrecks. The park has made these interpretive signs like you'd see on the side of a trail, except it's on the bottom of the ocean where it's this rock and it says, this was the Lugano. It sank in 1903. And it gives you this whole description. And you would have no idea if you just popped in and looked out at the water that something like that was there.
That's a park in Florida. And I'm here on the West Coast and we know and are so excited about our great national parks in the West and in the Rockies. There are a lot of parks in the East. Can you just quickly flip through a few of them? Just so we can give the parks in the east their due attention. What are some of the highlights of parks in the eastern United States?
Well, and what you're asking has been basically asked since the 1930s, where folks in the East initially felt like they'd gotten the short shrift when it came to national parks. So many of the iconic ones are in the West. Yosemite, Yellowstone, Arches, all of those, Glacier.
Right.
So the East got their parks a little later, but Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky, there's Acadia in Maine, which is where I started my year. That's a spectacular one. There's a lot of smaller ones. Part of that is that the East was settled first by Europeans, and so a lot of the land was taken up by towns at that point. But Congaree National Park in South Carolina is the last little bit left of the old growth bottomland hardwood forest. Looks kind of swampy and spooky. That's there. The most well-known is probably the Everglades, also in Florida. And then there's Dry Tortugas National Park, which is technically an eastern park, but it's a good 60 miles past the edge of Key West, this little island out in the middle of the ocean.
You know, one thing I felt that you have a particular interest in is trees, majestic trees, and how they actually relate to us. You mentioned every tree is a witness tree. They see how we spend our time on Earth and what we take and what we give. You saw the world's oldest tree in the Redwood National Park, or the tallest anyways. Talk a bit about trees and the power of trees that you can gain an appreciation for when you visit the parks.
Yeah, I mean, some of those I started calling celebrity trees because the parks have many of the superlative types of trees. So whether that's the largest, which is the General Sherman tree at Sequoia National Park, the tallest, which is in the Redwoods, and we don't know where it is because scientists realize that, I mean, someone knows where it is, but visitors don't.
Mm-hmm.
They were afraid that if people flocked to that specific tree, the roots would be damaged. It would just be too much of a scene. But every redwood is so much taller than any tree that you would see on the East Coast. Most of the iconic trees are clustered in the West. It's the only part of nature that I feel like sees me back. You know, I can walk by a beautiful mountain and I can go along the banks of a beautiful river. But when I'm underneath a canopy of those trees, I feel like they are looking at me. I don't know if that's, I've seen too much Wizard of Oz. I feel like they see me back.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Connor Knight. His book is Leave Only Footprints, My Acadia to Zion Journey Through Every National Park. Connor, thanks so much for sharing your experience. And can we just wrap up this conversation with a takeaway? You visited 59 national parks. Most of us would just love to visit a handful. How can we get the most out of our park experience, and why does that matter?
I mean, I think for me, it was appreciating the scenic diversity of our country, the fact that in one nation, we've got the deserts of Joshua Tree, the glaciers of Kenai Fjords, the murky swamps of the Everglades, and the rocky coast of Acadia. That is all in the U.S. really gave me an appreciation for these treasures that are in our backyard, and also a time away from technology, a time to physically challenge yourself. I mean, there's a lot of benefits that you get when you're out there on the trail, and a camaraderie with other folks. So it was the most scenic and the most transformative year of my life, and it will affect my thinking going forward.
And you visited them all in a year. I think we've got a lifetime of opportunities when we think of all the wonders our national park system has to offer.
A much saner way to experience them, by the way. I would recommend the lifetime approach versus the year approach.
Very good. Thanks, Connor.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tatton. Our associate producers are Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley. We get website support from Andrew Wakeling, affiliate promotions from Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Special thanks to our colleagues at Arizona Public Media for studio help this week. Find out when other radio stations air Travel with Rick Steves. You can find a list of our affiliates at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.